Hello. Yeah, the word Banti means teacher. I often think it is like an endearing name. It sounds like an endearing name that you give to someone, but actually it just means teacher. And people do use that word interchangeably, really, with Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita Banti are often used as equals. So, what I'm going to do, I'm going to talk a bit about Sangharakshita's life. I'm going to give a very short life story of Sangharakshita. Then I'm going to talk a bit about my life, a very short life story of me. And then I'm going to talk about the time that I spent with Sangharakshita. When I was living with him, we'd often sit and talk in the evenings. Most evenings we'd sit and talk for an hour or two. And then I'd go back to my room. He'd go to bed and I'd go to my room. And I'd make some notes of what we talked about. And over the last week or two preparing for this, I was rooting around looking for those notes. And there's page, like 50 pages of notes. Yeah. So I'm going to just... The main thing I'm going to do is read from some of those notes of my memories of conversations with Sangharakshita. Yeah. So Sangharakshita was born in 1925 in London, in, was it Tooting Broadway, he likes to remind people. And yeah, his childhood... I remember one thing, I probably shouldn't say this, but one thing he did tell me, probably in confidence, was I think I was probably not a very pleasant child. Yeah. I always liked things my own way, which, yeah, that's definitely a characteristic of Sangharakshita. When he was quite young, before he was 10, I think, he was diagnosed with a heart condition and spent a number of years in bed. He was told not to get excited and not to do any exercise. Everything was, he was served by his parents. And one of the things they served him was books. And apparently in that time he read the entire children's encyclopedia. And then the one doctor told him, there's nothing wrong with you, get up. Yeah. Another thing Sangharakshita told me around that time, we were talking about childhood, and he said, I have a strong, clear memory of age 6 or 7 or 8, riding up and down the road on my scooter, which my father had made for me. I still remember the wind rushing past my face as I whizzed along. I think that was my favourite occupation at that time. So, yeah, that was something of his childhood. When he was 19, I think, he got conscripted and went and joined the army, went out to India. And, yeah, he was in the army for a few years until he jumped over the wall and became a wandering monk and lived in India, wearing robes, begging for food. So this is a thin, bespectacled, slightly socially awkward English Victorian gentleman, really, living in India in the 1940s, he threw away all his possessions, he burnt his passport, very idealistic, very focused, driven young man, 19 years old, 20 years old, yeah? He had a begging bowl, and he'd wander India, just begging his food for the day, and if he didn't get any food, he wouldn't eat. He lost a lot of weight during that time. He also, around that time, I think he was in his early 20s, he wrote a book called A Survey of Buddhism, not The Survey. We often call it The Survey, it's not just A Survey of Buddhism. He's very clear about that. It's well worth a read if you fancy it. It's remember, it's written by a 25-year-old or so. It's often referred to as his, what's the word?
Magnum opus.
Magnum opus. It's often referred to as that. I find it a very... beautiful, poetic exposition of the path. Yeah. Very impressive book. So Sangharakshita was a monk. He had some internal conflict around this time. He was he was a bit of a dreamer and a bit of a poet, yeah. And he liked beauty. He once told me a story. I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'll mention it anyway. He was writing poetry all through that time in the army and as a wandering monk. And I once asked him how he first got into writing poetry. And he said, I remember as a child first coming across a poet. It was in a cartoon. It was in like maybe the Beano or something. And the poet was this very weedy child with spectacles. You know? And he'd sort of stand there holding a book and sniffing a rose. Yeah, and looking very weak. And then he'd go like this and gaze up at the skies, sort of in a rapturous state, at which point some young girl would come along and sprinkle pepper on the rose. So this was his introduction to the world of poetry. So anyway, he was a monk and he was a poet. And he felt there was conflict between those two things. The monk was supposed to not appreciate beauty, according to the tradition that he was involved with. The monk was supposed to be very austere and serious. Yeah. But Sangharakshita had this real love of beauty side, love of words and language and expression. So that was a conflict for him. He had eight teachers. There's not a picture of them on the shrine. There's often, when you see Sangharakshita, there's sort of nine figures. Yeah? Sangharakshita's in the bottom, in the middle, and around him are his eight teachers. He'd only met one of those when he wrote that book, The Survey of Buddhism, interestingly. So he had these eight teachers. Most of them were Tibetan teachers. I'll say a little bit more about those later. In some ways, he was once asked what he learned from his teachers. He'd already written that book, A Survey of Buddhism. So what did he learn from his teachers? And what he said was that he learned not what Buddhism is, but how to live as a Buddhist, which I thought was interesting. He met Dr. Ambedkar, who was a political reformer in India. And when Dr. Ambedkar died, an untimely death, Sangharakshita stepped in and helped Ambedkar's followers to take on the next step of what was going on. I'd certainly recommend studying around that area. There's a book that Sangharakshita wrote called Ambedkar and Buddhism about that time and about Ambedkar. I'm not going to say any more. So Sangharakshita lived in Kalimpong in the north of India and simply lived there as a monk, wrote, edited a magazine, had followers, disciples. He'd go on a tour of the plains every year when it wasn't too hot. After being in India for about 20 years, he was invited to the UK to do something with one of the Buddhist movements, I think the Buddhist Society. Yeah. So he came over to the UK. He wasn't a traditional monk in some ways. Yeah. He was a bit of an iconoclast. He was a bit of a... His teachers, the Tibetan teachers, were not conventional monks, Yeah. And so he wasn't that popular with the Buddhist Society in London, and they asked him not to come back. Yeah. I'll say a little bit more about that as well later. And so when that happened, I think he must have had a mischievous glint in his eye, yeah. And he realised that a new Buddhist movement was needed. What he saw of the Buddhist world in England in the mid-60s, he thought none of it really cut the mustard, and it wasn't wanting to be reformed in any way. So he'd form a new Buddhist movement. I think most of the Buddhist society was run by Christians at the time, and so he just thought, well, let's just start a new Buddhist movement. So he did, yeah? And that's what is now what we call Tri Ratna. Okay, so that's a little bit about Sangharakshita. So me, yeah? When I was 19, I went travelling, and I was on a search. I was searching for, I didn't know what at the time, but from the age of 19 to about 25, 26, maybe even 27, I was travelling the world. Every year, pretty much, I'd go away for a few months, 6 months, 9 months, 3 months, and often to mountainous areas of third world countries, and very lucky to have survived, to be honest. Didn't really know what I was searching for, but I was definitely dissatisfied. I'd find myself in some far-flung city or mountainous region, and I'd just get bored. So I'd go back to London and smoke lots of weed and drink lots of tea, and after a few months I'd just get bored. So I'd go travelling again, and after 6 months in Turkey I'd get bored, so I'd go back to London. And that was what my life was like at the time. It was great, I had lots of adventures, but it was a bit hollow. One of my journeys took me to Pakistan. I was there for 3 months, and I was in India for 6 months. And during that time in India, I came across Buddhism. And it was like such a relief. Yeah. One of my first thoughts when I got into Buddhism was, thank God for that, I can stop travelling now. Because I'd found a journey. I'd found a journey that had more meaning or more depth. It was the inner journey. It was meditation and discovering who I was, in a sense. One thing I was clear about at that time was that I could stop travelling. I wanted to find Buddhism in my culture. Yeah, I'd spent the first half of my 20s trying to understand other people's cultures, turning my back very dismissively on my own. I remember coming back to England and being on a train and just looking out the window and seeing a church behind oak trees and just like, this is my country. Yeah, I want to discover me in my country. Yeah? So I came back to England and I looked at a few Buddhist movements and very quickly found Triratna. One of the main emphases is you don't have to be a Tibetan or a Japanese. You find the Dharma, you find the path in your own roots. Yeah. So a Buddhist movement that respected our cultural history, yeah, Jung and Schopenhauer and the whole sort of movement of equality that's been going on in the last decades, that just respected that as part of the wallpaper of life. But also a path that emphasised friendship seemed really important. One of the things about travellers, when I was a traveller, one of the things I liked about that was that you'd meet someone, like several people a day usually, and it was great. You get on like a house on fire. Half an hour later, or 2 days later, you go off and you never see them again. So you have this very strange experience of being very gregarious and very socially connected. And in a sense, you can invent yourself every day, because it's a new person every day. But there's depth, because you can just be completely honest, because you're never going to meet them again. But there's no soul to it. Yeah? There's no substance to it. That's how I felt after 6 years of travelling. So to come across a Buddhist movement that emphasised friendship was like a breath of fresh air. It was an amazing experience for me. I went to the Manchester Buddhist Centre where there was a building project, and it was a bunch of scruffy people with a warehouse and no money and very, very few skills. My dad had taught me how to build a rabbit hutch, which made me by far the most experienced carpenter. And so, yeah, that was just wonderful for me, yeah. I was very grateful to Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita was talked about a lot in those days in Manchester. He was really, Balajit was there a year or two after I left, and yeah, Sangharakshita was really held in high esteem there. I met him once there. When all that building project ended and my wonderful building site turned into a Buddhist centre a bit like this one, I suddenly felt totally not at home. almost not welcome, although of course I was, but it was no longer a building site where I could be useful, and it was just a Buddhist centre. I wasn't interested. So I ended up moving to Padmaloka, which was a retreat centre in Norfolk, and Sangharakshita had used to live there. I went there as the maintenance man, so I was doing, or supposed to be doing, maintenance work, building work. I got more and more into meditation while I was there. I was there for about 5 years, and by the end I was meditating 4 times a day. And just getting less and less interested in work. I'd never been that interested in work, but more interested in meditation. Around this time, I got ordained whilst I was at Padmaloka as well. Around this time, Sangharakshita's eyesight started to go. He lost his sight. My dad had lost his sight when I was a teenager, so I was used to people who couldn't see. I sort of knew you have to communicate with them in a different way because they can't pick up the visual signals of when you stop talking or when you're talking to them. So you have to, you know, it's subtle, but it makes a big difference. So when I met Bhante, I'm quite good at not putting people on pedestals. So I did a seminar with Bhante. There was like 6 order members went to do a seminar with Sangharakshita. And people are sort of, they treat him in a bit of awe, yeah. And, oh, Bhante, oh, it's Bhante. But I'd just sit next to him and chat to him and, you know, touch his hand when I spoke to him so he knew that I was speaking to him. And we got on in a really easy, familiar way. So when he got ill, I got a phone call from Subhuti, would I like to move to Madhyamaloka, to Birmingham, to look after Sangharakshita? And I said no, because I was quite happy living at Padmaloka. I was enjoying that. But then I thought, this man has given so much to me. Yeah? He's given so much to so many of my friends. Maybe I can give a little bit back. Yeah? So I thought about it, and I phoned Subhuti back up, and I got him to be clear what actually I was required to do. And I said, okay, I'll come and look after Sangharakshita, but I won't do anything else. Is that all right? Yes. Okay, I'm going to hold you to that. Yeah. And I also wanted to be part of the chapter so I could just be really part of that community and be there for Sangharakshita, but not have any other, like, you know what Buddhists are like? They get so busy. Yeah. And there's always more to do than there is people to do it. Yeah. But I just thought, no, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to go there and I'm going to meditate. And I'm going to look after Sangharakshita. So I got on the train. No, actually, Padmadaka drove me to Birmingham. I think I went to a shop on the way, and I basically traded in my steel toe-cap work boots and bought a pair of carpet slippers as a symbolic shift of what was happening. So I moved to Birmingham. This is 12 or so years ago, 13 years ago, and I lived a very, very simple life, meditating, studying. I'd made a program of my daily activities once, and I was meditating for, I think, 3 or 4 hours in the morning, and then having breakfast, then doing a couple of hours of study, and, you know, maybe exercise in the afternoon, and then meditation and stuff in the evening. So I was totally free. Yeah, I was living in a community of people who were very, very busy. And I was like, but my job, I had a mobile phone. And at any time, 24/7, Sangharakshita could call me. Yeah? So that took the pressure off everybody else in the community. They could get on with their busy lives, knowing that Sangharakshita had what he needed. He could always ask me to help him. So I did feel like I'd moved to the mountain hermitage with my old and suffering teacher. Yeah? This is in Moseley. So, yeah, serving Sangharakshita, cooking for him, cleaning, just being company for him when he was unwell. He had insomnia. He got very bad insomnia. I don't know if you know what it's like when you get insomnia. He got very anxious at times. He It was, yeah, it really was like torture. He'd use that word, it's like torture. He would appear irrational at times, some of his requests, some of his needs. And I was there to serve, really, just to help. I'll just read something that I wrote. This was a really strong experience for me. This morning I was woken from a dreamful sleep by Sangharakshita calling my name. He was up and needed me to turn off the flat alarm, his eyesight being too poor as of the past year, and to make his breakfast. I had some resentment as I busied myself finishing the fridge defrost and clean and making porridge. As I finished and was washing pans, I felt I knew what St. Francis of Assisi had meant when he said that his happiest moment was when he was walking through a long, cold, wet, dark night in a forest, and he saw in the distance a light amongst the trees. And he thought, ah, relief, I can get some food, I can get some shelter. And he went to it, and it was a solitary cottage, and he knocked on the door, and the door opened, and he was shouted at, go away, you lazy friar, we don't want the likes of you here. And he felt happiest, that was the happiest moment of his life, and the moment where he felt most in touch with God, apparently. And I got, that was my St. Francis of Assisi moment, yeah, when Bantam woke me up and I was doing stuff resentfully. And I realised, I'll just continue reading what I wrote later on that day. My working for Banti's pleasure and convenience, I'm putting aside myself. I'm forced to become motivated by my love for Banti. Though on some level this is grim and uncomfortable, there is a deep cleanness and rightness. My negativity is thrown into the light and at some time overwhelmed, or at least overridden, by my love and care for Banti, for the Buddha and for the Dharma and the Sangha. My love and faith is given a channel to shine forth, to shine through. I'm left walking through my day, not in bed, not in nice warm cottage. I'm alone, in love with my path, deeply connected with my renunciation of the comforts of a householder life, and deeply connected with Sangharakshita. So it's a very simple life. I wrote something else here which, just reading it the other day, seemed to sum up the mood that I was in those years. To depend upon the Dharma is to depend upon nothing. To live the Dharma is to live fully where you are, to be free of expectations and assumptions, to be present and responsive, to be openly engaged, spontaneous and joyful. So, yeah, Sangharakshita was having a very, very hard time. He felt he was being tortured. Sometimes he would not get any sleep for days and days, if not weeks on end. But he never gave up. He never gave up trying to cure himself or find the way forward. We'd often talk about, or I'd ask him, what's keeping you awake? Is there anything keeping you awake? Is there anything that it would be useful to talk about or to do? And he just racked his mind and he couldn't find anything of that nature. We'd go to Rosie Roper, the acupuncturist. I'd drive him there once a week. And he'd have acupuncture, and that really seemed to help. I remember once she had a waiting room. It was actually the porch of her house, so it was tiny. Yeah? You could just fit a chair in it. And I once remember said to Bansi, I'm going to sit in the car, the waiting room is too small. And he said, "Cool, some people are so fussy. You could sit there and imagine you were in your coffin. You could meditate on impermanence, on death. You have a comfortable chair. If you close your eyes, you could be anywhere." So that was a, humorous, I felt, little digging. So yeah, we see Kathy most weeks, Rosie most weeks. There was a woman called Kathy Wu. She was a Chinese-American. I don't know where she'd come across Sangharakshita. I think on the internet, so it might be through a book. She lived in America. She lived in a monastery, nearby a monastery, looking after an elderly monk. And she came across one of Sangharakshita's books, and she decided that there were two enlightened people on the planet, Sangharakshita and this obscure old Chinese monk, which I'd never heard of. And so she decided to get in touch with him. She discovered he was unwell. So she came to England at her own expense and insisted on looking after him. And we really tried to keep her at arm's length. She was really challenging individual. But she really insisted, and I think she saved Sangharakshita's life. She'd cook for him. She'd come into the kitchen at 5 o'clock in the morning and cook his lunch. You know, she'd spend hours and hours cooking lunch. Sometimes I'd drive her around Birmingham looking for exactly the right type of spinach, you know, or exactly the right something or other. She was such a devotee. She was very critical of me. For example, Sangharakshita had holes in his socks. And how, Saraha? This is your teacher. You should buy him socks. Which, that's not my path, sorry. That's your path of devotion and service. We used to call it Chinese Coca-Cola. She'd say things like, "Coca-Cola, the first 2 inches of your tongue loves it. The next 30 feet, it's very bad, very bad." So she made this stuff for Sangharakshita out of Chinese herbs. And she trained me how to cook it up, and you'd boil it up, and it had all sorts of stuff in it. It was black, yeah. And it stank the house out. Oh. And Banti's face when he drank it was so bitter. His face, he was like... And she wanted him to drink it four times a day. She wanted him to set an alarm to wake him up in the middle of the night, drink this revolting stuff to help him sleep. He wouldn't do that, Sangharakshita. He wouldn't do that. Anyway, we used to call it Chinese Coca-Cola, which was always entertaining. I used to take him to the doctor, local doctor. One time he said, I think we were in the car on the way to the doctor, and he said, "Saraha, the body is like a car. Look after it well. But remember, it will end up on a scrap heap." Another thing he said was that he wasn't expecting old age. He was expecting death. He was prepared for death, he felt, but he wasn't expecting old age. So it was a bit of a shock. Another thing that I wrote, this is what made me laugh to reread this. So Banti and I would spend a couple of hours together in the evening, and then at bedtime, pretty much always the same time, unless we got engrossed in conversation, he'd go to bed. So we'd go to his room, and I'd put his eye drops in, his eyes, and then we'd sit on his bed, and he'd take his pills. And one day, this is what I wrote afterwards, Banti swallowed his big pill. He had one really big pill, I'm not sure what that was for, sitting on his bed by throwing his head up and back. And I said, "That's how herons swallow fish." And Sangharakshita said, "Yes, in Cannon Hill Park, we saw a heron catch a really big fish, and down it went." I said that I'd seen a cormorant catch a huge eel, and it took 20 minutes to get it down its throat. "Imagine," I said, "swallowing a whole fish." "Yes," said Banti. "It must keep wriggling for quite a while inside." for a heron, that must be a nice comforting feeling. And we sat both quietly, chuckled for some time, sitting on his bed, and then a smiling good night, and Sangharakshita said, I hope your back is very much better in the morning. So yeah, we lived simply. There was a very simple routine to our days. He once told me a little story of when he was in India, and he met a coolie. A coolie came to see him. A coolie's a labourer, so a farm labourer or a labourer on the building site. And he said, this coolie came to see him, and the coolie, the labourer, described what his day is like. And the coolie said to Sangharakshita, I work all day. At the end of the day, I receive my wage. I go to the market, I buy some vegetables, and I take them home to my wife. My wife cooks and I eat. I live like a king. And that, you know, there was something about that attitude I felt with Sangharakshita at that time, with the simpleness. Often, one story I often remember is that he'd listen to music on headphones sometimes. And I'd take him a cup of tea, and he'd press pause, and he'd take the headphones off, and he'd hold the tea, and he'd drink the tea. And when he'd finished, he'd put the tea down, he'd put the headphones back, and he'd press play. Very, very simple. Yeah, I'm like, music, Facebook, work, phone. He was just so simple, yeah, so one-pointed with all that. We'd also talk about our dreams. We'd tell it, if we had dreams in the night, we'd tell each other our dreams. And sometimes he wrote a number of poems. And this particular one, I remember trying to persuade him to publish it, but he didn't want to, yeah. That's my memory. So I was really pleased. This came out a couple of days ago. This is a Moseley miscellany. Sangharakshita, his years in Moseley. Anyway, he did publish this poem in here. It's called Queens Past and Present. And I dedicate this poem to Pete, who I live with. He's not here. Elizabeth Tudor was frequently ruder than queens are today. She boxed courtiers' ears, swore roundly at peers, and had plenty to say for herself in English, French, Latin, Greek, Spanish, and Italian. She could ride a stallion as well as a man and flutter a jewelled fan with the best of the saucy aristocratic girls who arranged her red curls. What a pity that in London city our sovereign lady today should be so polite, well-mannered and grey. So yeah, he did have a cheeky side. One thing we often talked about was friends, his friends, sometimes my friends. And I, you know, strong memories of Sangharakshita just expressing love for his friends. And yeah, his flat was full of stuff. Often to me it would just look like he's full of junk. Yeah, just so many knickknacks and all sorts of stuff. But if I ever asked him about any of them, he'd go, oh yeah, so-and-so gave me that in 1982. Something, yeah. He had so many possessions, and he remembered who they were from quite often. I'd often read him, Shabda to him, the order newsletter, and there's all sorts of order members talking about their practice, order members talking about what they're doing in their spiritual life or in their life generally. And sometimes it does make you raise an eyebrow. But Sangharakshita would often just, I remember saying once, what's he doing? What's that? And Sangharakshita just said, I have total confidence in him. I have total confidence in his practice. That's a real memory of mine of Sangharakshita's confidence in his friends, particularly in order members in their practice. This is something I wrote. Bhante said, he said, "I'm now quite philosophical about friends. They come and they go. They go for various reasons. Death, they move away, we drift apart. I know so many people. I've written hundreds, thousands of letters. In India, 12 per day was common, and postcards, hundreds. In terms of close friends, one can only have a few, and you mentioned a few names. There are others who have died," and Bhante looked very sad, his mouth heavy and distorted like a large frog in his throat. I think one of the things that he was always clearest at was that people should express their own views. Yeah. I remember in one of the things I read him in Shabda, Subhuti, who's a senior order member, had been publicly criticised. And Sangharakshita said, he should remember that Subhuti is an order member and just saying what he believes. If all order members engage with the Dharma, then that will set the direction for the movement, and we don't need to worry. Subhuti has stated his views fully. He said he would like the college to discuss what he said. It's very important that everyone, including Subhuti, can state their views frankly. So that's, he often was like that. I remember I won't mention that. I remember coming back to the flat once, and I'd been at a council meeting. So we have a council meeting at the Buddhist Centre every few months, and we try and do everything by consensus. So we don't vote, and we don't... So that sometimes means that it takes a lot of time to discuss stuff. Yeah. And I came back after what I thought was a difficult discussion in the council meeting, and Bhante said, "How was the council?" And I said, "Well, it was painful." And I think I filled in something of what had been happening. And Bhante said, "Well, there is another way, you know. You could have a dictator." "It's either that, or you spend a lot of time thrashing issues out. And," he said, "it's good to stick with it. You're learning how to articulate your views clearly, rationally, and forcefully." So I thought that was really good, yeah? Learning to articulate your views clearly, rationally, and forcefully. Yeah? And there have been some great council meetings where we're all trying to do that. And get there in the end, don't we? So quite often, me being me, me doing a lot of stuff at the Buddhist Centre here, I'd come back from a class and I'd sit with Sangharakshita for a bit and I'd ask him about the movement and what are we doing? You know, what am I doing? What's the Buddhist Centre all about? And what's the movement all about? And I'd say, the order's like this, isn't it? And he'd be, "No, don't generalise. The order's not like that. Order members are all different. Yeah? People are all different. Don't generalise." I found that frustrating. Sometimes I felt I couldn't talk to Sangharakshita about the movement because everything I said, he'd say, "No, that's not a general thing. That's just that particular order member or those particular order members." So he was always bringing me back to be an individual. Lots of bits of paper. I was once asking him, I often experience doubt in Buddhism. I remember asking him once, "Why do we practice? Yeah? Come on, why do we do this? Why do we practice? It's hard, isn't it? We all know it's hard to meditate. It's hard to practice. It's hard to purify the mind." And Bhante said, "All people have some contact with other people. If your mind is pure, that contact will tend to be more positive, kind, and helpful." which that does it for me, really. That's a motive to practice. That's a motive to purify my mind. What should I study? I asked him once. What should I study with my study group? And he said, fundamental stuff that is necessary and useful to them. Do they believe in the possibility of enlightenment? That seemed to be the most important thing, yeah? Do they believe in the possibility of enlightenment? Do they understand? Are they familiar with Paticca Samuppada? How many of the links do they know? Study bits from the history of my going for refuge, he said. Study bits from the first section of the Ten Pillars. I said, I'm into studying the Pali Suttas. That's always a good idea. That bit's for Sagramatic. Oh yeah, tell them something about how to lead classes. This is on that subject still. Tell them about Tri Ratna. Tell them that we're a worldwide movement. Tell them about what Buddhism is. Make sure they understand that they can become less unskillful and less unhappy. Yeah? When people come to the Buddhist Centre, make sure they understand they can become less unskillful and less unhappy, and they can become more skillful, more happy, and lead a meaningful life. Really simple, yeah? Change, especially through meditation, ethics, and friendships, is possible. And remember that ideas familiar to us will be strange to others. Remember that meditation is an instrument of change. One time, sometimes we'd drive to other parts of the country, once we went to Germany, and visit other centres. And I remember talking to Banti after one of these trips once, and he said, I've visited 10 centres in the last few years, and I see no major cause for concern. People are getting on with their practice, friendships, study, their lives. Yes, there are difficulties, often on an interpersonal nature. Some Buddhist traditions, he said, have very authoritarian structures. We, or rather I, haven't chosen that model. As long as we have a good core of committed people, we can afford to be a bit ragged around the edges, and loose, and anarchistic. We as a movement are more likely in the long run to lose people by lowering our standards than by raising or maintaining them. Stand your ground. I think I'd obviously upset someone. Stand your ground, Banti said. It sounds like you have pricked a few consciences. Order members often know that they could be doing more, should be doing more. If one is really going for refuge, then one will be building the pure land. One will engage and help other people. Yeah. Okay. Being a bit provocative in order to get a response is not necessarily an unskillful thing to do. The Buddha was sometimes harsh, calling people fools. So yeah, we'd often talk about what was going on in the order and the movement, talk about the various practices that people are doing. I think I got into this sort of chod practice for a while. I got very interested in it. And if you want to know anything about that, then you'll find out about it. But heed this warning first, yeah? So me and Banti talked about chod and the Matchik Ladron. Beware of watering down, beware of domesticating Tibetan practices. The founder of chod lived in a forest, had nothing left to offer to the Buddha, so she offered her body. This presupposes a very high level of renunciation prior to chod practice. One goes to a lonely place, actually surrounded by flesh-eating demons, and offers one's body to them as food. To do chod sitting surrounded by one's possessions is like reading Milarepa whilst munching a box of chocolates. Some value as an imaginative meditation practice, but it is not chod, it is a domesticated version. This was in the car to Rosie's. He said, nowadays people want everything when they want it. Most people need to put much more into the so-called early stages of the path. You shouldn't do the six element practice or reflection practices unless you're fully committed to the spiritual life, unless you really want to kill your ego. Okay. I remember talking once with him about, I think he went to Taplow Court to give a talk, and this is what I wrote. We had a conversation when he got back. He said, at the end of my talk, I said that the three biggest Buddhist movements in Britain, Soka Gakkai, the NKT, and Triratna, FWBO as it was then, well, Banji said, these three are all controversial. Someone should do a study of them and see what they have in common. We might find the likely way forward for British Buddhism. Are they popular because they are controversial or despite it? And I said, perhaps they are controversial because they are popular. Yes, maybe that. Though we were controversial from the very beginning. So on the subject of controversy, I don't really want to talk about this. It's Sangharakshita's 90th birthday, but I'm going to a little bit. Just because he was such a big part of my life in Birmingham, or my life with Sangharakshita. If you've done any research on Triratna or on Sangharakshita, you'll have come across criticism of Sangharakshita. We are controversial. We were from the very beginning. So a big part of that criticism revolved around a letter that an order member called Yashamitra wrote to Shabda, public letter. And my first evening in the community in Moseley, I came to Birmingham. I was 33. I'd just been ordained a year. I was suddenly in this community with Subhuti and Sona and Sangharakshita and all these scary big people. And the first dinner table conversation was, well, guys, there's going to be a storm next month. Yashamitra's letter has just written a letter to Shabda. And so what came after? Well, I'll just tell a little bit of the story of Sangharakshita. Basically, Sangharakshita came in for a lot of criticism in those while he was ill. Yeah. And so sometimes people would talk to me about it, obviously, because I knew Sangharakshita, so I was a good person to talk to about it. So I talked to Sangharakshita about it. And the perspective that he would give me was that he came back from India. It was the 1960s. He said, I came back to England just before my 39th birthday, and a whole new life was starting for me. There was the starting of the FWBO. Then there was also my personal life and a sexual life, which even a few years previously would have been a criminal offence. He was homosexual, so it would have been a criminal offence a few years previously. So he came back to England, he came back to London. The summer of free love was happening all around him. His experiences in India of sexually secretive monks were fresh in his mind. He said, I rejected, or rather didn't adopt, the rigid emphasis on celibacy that in some religious circles is advocated. Several of my teachers, Tibetan lamas in robes, had sex lives, as did on the sly some of the Theravadan ones. Of those Theravadan monks who had sex lives, Bounty said that they were obviously bad monks, but I knew them quite well personally, and they were very good Buddhists. They did a lot of work for the Dharma. So he was very clear that the new Buddhist movement that he was setting up mustn't separate our lives and our spiritual lives. Yeah? It mustn't say, if you're a monk or a nun, you're more spiritual than if you've got a family or if you've got a sex life. Definitely it mustn't be homophobic. That was a very strong principle for Sangharakshita when he started things. Yeah, Dilgo Khenso Rinpoche was married with two daughters. He had long hair and he wore robes. So Sangharakshita came in that spirit, the spirit of Tri Ratna, those role models of his teachers, the sort of anti-role models of the secretive monks who were having sex on the sly, and the swinging 60s. So Sangharakshita let his hair down. And then I arrived in Birmingham, and there was this big wave of criticism started about his sex life, which was sort of with people in the noughties, in the 2000s, looking back on his life and being very critical. And so a lot of my time I was sat there with Sangharakshita, sometimes holding his hand as he wept with the suffering of not being able to sleep. And sometimes I'd be talking with people who thought I should be forcing him to confess his sins. Yeah. He'd asked, you know, he couldn't sleep, so obviously I was being very careful what I talked to him about, but it was a very painful time for me that, you know, a lot of my time with this, you know, he's like a child, you know, what old men are like when they're ill. He's very tender, very soft. Vulnerable, open human being. And then so many other people were just relating to him like some terrible authority figure, yeah, who should be brought to trial. Yeah. You know how in our English culture, we're so good at that, aren't we? If anyone, look at what they're trying to do with Jeremy Corbyn, yeah? Trying to find out all the dirt from his past. Apparently he ate baked beans and wouldn't take his wife to the cinema, yeah, because he wanted to stay at home and read politics. Yeah. You can see the press really trying to find any controversy. That's what happened with Sangharakshita for some time. So sometimes I'd come back from the Buddhist Centre and I'd been having a number of conversations with people about their difficulties with Sangharakshita. And I especially mentioned, this is what I wrote one day back in 2007, I especially mentioned that the most common problem that people have is not with what happened, but with your silence. As the time goes by, the silence for some people gets louder. Bounty talked about people trying to bully him into saying something, anything, to calm things down. Sangharakshita expressed disappointment in people seeming to make up their minds about the matter after having read Yashamitra's story without waiting to hear his. So I think he sort of dug his heels in when he noticed that happen, which was probably not great, but that seemed to be what he did. People, he said, if they've got a problem, they should come and talk to me personally. And I always encourage people to go and talk to him personally. He didn't want to talk publicly about such personal things, but is able to do so individually or in a small group. So how to go from that to the next bit. I just want to... I just want to mention a couple of other things. In my years with Sangharakshita, I never saw him meditate. Once I saw him and I thought, that wasn't mindful. Yeah, once in 5 or 6 years, that wasn't mindful. I never saw him meditate. But I asked him once about sadhana. Sadhana is a practice that order members do often, visualizing Buddhas or Buddha Bodhisattvas. I asked him about his sadhanas, and he said, in the last couple of years, I've mainly done the Tara sadhana, sometimes Manjugosha, sometimes Vajrasattva. And we talked in fair detail about how he did that. But he wasn't doing it sitting in formal meditation. He was, maybe when he was just sitting in his chair, or whilst I was sitting there rabbiting on about what I'd been doing at the Buddhist Centre, he was engaging in this. Yeah. And very strong experience for me around that time, which I gets a brief mention in this book, The Mostly Miscellany. And I'll just finish with this story. So often he would, or every day he would try and have an afternoon nap, and he'd sit in his chair, and he had one of those chairs that you can recline at, so he'd be lying on his back in his chair, and he'd sit there, he'd lie there and see if he could try and sleep. And often, sometimes he would, and usually he wouldn't. And often what I would do, I'd sit in meditation on the floor next to him. And you know what it's like when you meditate, you sit there and you get distracted, and you come back and you get distracted, and you come back and you get distracted, and you come back and you get distracted. But a number of times I'd have very enjoyable meditations, and a number of times I'd be sitting there, and the room would fill with green light. Yeah, my eyes were closed, the room would fill with beautiful green light. Yeah. And the Tara mantra would be there. And just as this happened, Bhante would go, and he'd lie there snoring for 20 or 30 minutes, and I'd be sat there with this green light. And then the green light would go, and he'd go,